Working Cows Podcast, episode 195.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network. Very excited to be joined today by Troy Bishop. Troy is the grass whisperer, according to his website, and Troy has been involved in whatever you want to call it for a long time. Regenerative agriculture, holistic management. We'll get into Troy's titles for it today. But Troy's been doing it for a long time, and so I'm really looking forward to talking to him about his context and about how he thinks about his involvement in agriculture more broadly. So, Troy, thanks for joining me on the Working Cows podcast today.
Great to be here, Clay. I appreciate you having me on from the great state of New York.
Yeah, definitely. We're kind of on a trend here. We started out in eastern Kansas, and then we pushed a little bit farther east into Ohio, and here we are a little farther east yet into New York. So I don't get enough exposure to agriculture east of the 100th meridian, and I will probably call you a rancher at some point, even though I think once you get past that 100th meridian, they're farms anyways. So I'll probably mess that up at some point in this episode, but could you just give me a little bit of perspective on your operation, how you're involved in agriculture?
Sure. It is funny that you mentioned ranchers and farmers. There's always a weird definition. Well, it's not clear. I heard from a rancher at a meat grazing meeting in Missouri that it seems there's a trend. If you wear a baseball cap, you're more like a farmer, I guess. Yep. If you have a cowboy hat, you're more like a rancher, but maybe it's the boots, the jeans, the size of the farm or ranch. You know, we should really dive into that. What is the definition? Anyway, whatever you want to call it, we have land here in central New York. We're right along the thruway, right in the center between Syracuse and Albany, in a little hamlet here. I thank God that my great-great-grandparents bought this land, because somehow they knew we had high-lime soils. And we have 7 springs on our 100-acre farm here, and it's basically it rises from the flat on plateaus all the way up about 1200 feet elevation, and really does make for an awesome place to grow grass. So that's basically, I've inherited this land, I've worked this land, I've lived this land, and so I'm lucky to have my parents on the farm. My dad's a retired accountant. So you might get a little twinge. He likes numbers, stock markets and things. And my wife and I live here, and my daughters live close by. I have some grandchildren. And so we've had a long history. I used to be a dairy farmer here, and that didn't go so well because the pricing was terrible. So we decided to get out before we're saddled with a lot of debt. And then it kind of morphed into a custom grazing operation. And then I would work off the farm. So I actually had quite an extensive fence business, and I farmed. And then I sold that business, and I did some other stuff. And then I did some other stuff, and I worked in a quarry, and I did some other stuff, and I kept farming. And then I expanded because my customer base wanted more land to do custom grazing. At one point, I was up to 700 acres of leased land and 300 head of cattle and running around a 20-mile circumference and working off the farm. So I guess I'm a workaholic. So I've always worked off the farm. I've always had side gigs. And so the grazing, the farm here, it gives us wonderful benefits from income to enjoyment to learning. And I also, I've been at the conservation district just over the border of my county and Madison County for 16 years. I'm coming up on my 16th year in agency life, which is very, very interesting. And during that time, somebody trained me. They were doing stuff with farmers and agency folks. Hey, you should learn how to do media, and you should learn, you know, how to sound bite and learn all the techniques. And so I went to a training, and lo and behold, I found a writing career. And then I started taking pictures, and now I'm basically a freelance writer, photographer for various papers, including our state has the Country Folks, they call it. So I'm in there maybe every week, maybe every couple weeks. I might have an opinion. I might write a feature story. Last week, it's never happened, but I had two cover photos, one in each edition. So that was cool. You know, I have a camera on my hip at all times, like not your smartphone camera, like like an old, like a point and shoot. But the point is, I always have one, and so it really does help me tell stories.
Absolutely. So my wife and I are talking about going back to dumb phones. That was one of the things we decided we would miss is the camera. You know, you just capture so many more moments in a high quality than you do, you know, you use that tool to capture a lot of moments in high quality. Sure. That you would be a little bit limited on other ways, but I'm sure there's other ways to.
There's so much, so much to learn in the kind of the media realm. Even to the effect that, like, you have to take a vertical picture if you want to showcase your work in a magazine. And so you have to always be thinking about future uses. So if you see a cow and a calf or something pretty, you almost have to take two pictures, one horizontal and one vertical, because you never know who might want that.
Right. Huh. Yeah. And if somebody wants it for YouTube, they want the horizontal. If they want it for a magazine, they want it vertical.
And the resolution has to be on point. It has to be 1 megabit or more, because they're going to want to crop it. Or if they blow it up, it can't be grainy. So it's like just super simple stuff. But, you know, every picture is worth a few bucks.
Yeah.
So that contributes to the overall farming. So yeah. So I farm, I work, I take pictures, I talk, and then somewhere I sleep.
Huh. That's a novel idea. Yeah. I always say sleep is overrated and underpaid. Okay, so let's back up. Dairy to custom grazing. Talk to me about that. Why custom grazing? Why not go out and buy some 1,600 pound cows? I mean, you grow grass more than you can probably get them to eat. So why not just buy some 1,600 pound cows and turn them out to eat all the grass they want?
Well, I have a cow fetish, you know, I have to have cows, just what I have to have. And, it's more profitable to have somebody pay you to graze than to own them. And that really is the feature of custom grazing is, you know, you get paid to, they eat grass. You have a performance measure, you know, they have to gain weight or they have to finish or, you know, whatever the metric is. So your customer will keep paying you. There's basically,
sure.
I've said in these custom grazing, somebody said to me, well, what does your contract look like? And I said, it looks like two people having a handshake, and that's pretty much where it ends. So if you can't, a piece of paper doesn't mean much if you can't shake hands. And
right.
So that, I'm not going to say at all that it's lucrative. It is one way to make some money off your talents, your grass, and know full well that everything that happens on a farm that owns cows happens on a farm that custom grazes cows from death to life to storms, dry periods, floods, hurricanes, all that kind of good stuff. So, you know, you have to be just as resilient. It's just that you basically, if you do a good job, you basically have guaranteed income.
Right. So when and how did you come to the conclusion that that was more lucrative than owning the cows?
Well, I have to admit that I just put an ad in the paper to get to try it. Because it was an idea that wasn't mine back in the day, which I've decided that I've been in the grazing business almost 40 years.
Nice.
So whatever back in the day is, Stockman Grass Farmer probably was showcasing custom grazing and so forth and so on. So I just actually just put a $5 ad in the Country Folks newspaper, and lo and behold, someone called. So we actually started with 35 head on 100 acres. Obviously, that was for me, that was good because it was small. We had way too much grass. You know, it was kind of gross around here. There was so much feed, but the cows did really well. The customer had 100 cow calf pairs. And so that relationship spawned into other relationships, and then his trucker had some cows, and you know, it was word of mouth after that.
Sure.
And to this day, it's still word of mouth. Actually, people call me and say, "Do you have any room?" Which is super sweet to have it. At one point in the highlights, because there's been highlights and kind of low lights, we actually took a set of cattle from Glenn Barlow's ranch in Wyoming.
Yeah.
And he was in the same type of situation with the dry. And I was friends with Gerald Fry.
Yep.
And they wanted to get closer to New York City to sell these. And they wanted to, so anyway, they basically took them out of there, dropped them in our place, and we weighed them. We did a lot of cool stuff. And, you know, we did our custom grazing thing. And so when you get those relationships and you do good work and there's good animal performance and things, people want to work with you. And so it's, your good work is incentivized,
yep,
to get more work. It's pretty plain and simple business, actually. And, you know, you're going to have different kinds of customers and this and that. And so it's just been an sort of a ebbs and flows, because life takes over. You have children, you have challenges and opportunities, and we at 58, next week's my birthday. So, we have, slowed down. We have given up all the leased land, and we've concentrated our efforts because we're busy people. And we want some time for ourselves. And so we basically came home. we gave up all our leased land over the years and we're home. So we have enough cows, we have an awesome customer, and we finish beef. So we're custom finishers.
Cool.
I could own cows if I wanted, but I don't need to. I have plenty of cows.
Okay, and so a couple of things. I know where Glen Barlow lives, and I know that area anyways, and it is not New York by any stretch of the imagination. It is hot and dry and windy and other things. And I've heard it said that you shouldn't take cattle east because of the parasite load issues. How did that go?
Well, it's I like to call them pilot projects, you know.
Yeah.
Cuz that's doesn't scare people. So I sort of had nothing to do with it. I had land available and I had management experience, and Gerald wanted to learn about these genetics cuz they were they had Angus Devon, I think. So what I did learn, because they did weigh them, which is very interesting, the parasite load, whatever. We weren't worried because we were moving them around.
Sure.
It's, you know, parasites, it's somewhat of a misnomer if you're, you know, really moving cattle.
Yep.
But so anyway, that group of cows, when they dropped off that truck, they all looked the same. It's amazing. I still have pictures and I still have wonder how a set of cattle could be almost identical. And so what was weird though, because Gerald Fry was involved and there was a ton of people learning about grass-fed genetics and grazing and whatever, is from top to bottom, the top 20, it was a pot load, so I don't know how many that was, 50 or 60.
Yep.
The top percentage gained 3.5 pounds of gain a day on native New York pastures. So then the second tier probably gained somewhere around 2 to 2.25. And, you know, then you could go down from there. But I remember that at least 10 that looked exactly like the others only gained 0.5 pound a day.
Huh.
And they all were on the same management. So even when, you know, we talk about the genetic pool and grazing and doing all these great things, you know, there's just stuff that happens. And so basically, I guess what Gerald had come up with, God rest his soul, is kill the mothers of the ones and keep the other ones or the bulls or whatever from the top ones. Right. And there you go.
So,
but how would you know? Right. You didn't if you don't measure, you can't make decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a big problem. I don't know if it's a problem, but it's a big issue facing agriculture, is that we just don't know what that, you know, especially in the West, a lot of times that calf at 6-7 months old gets on a truck and we never see him again. So we have no idea how he performs, you know, and we just have to take the order buyer's word for it that his customer wants another load of those calves like they were last year. And so...
And
so much of it is an economy of scale where death, loss, and poor performing animals are built into the matrix. So you never really know which individuals are really the superior individuals.
Yeah. You know, it does feel like I'm going way back, but when Gerald was working grass-fed genetics and really starting, Alan Williams was starting too. And so he was on the farm measuring, doing ultrasound, you know, measuring tenderness scores and things. We were some of the first ones in the East to actually do this.
Wow.
I as the farmer / manager, grazer, whatever, you know, I tried to give them the best feed as possible, the best management, And, you know, the genetics had to take care of themselves, but it's pretty amazing to watch in those early days how much variability were in families of cows and things, and which came to some fruition why I do everything by the day. Because if you got a top performing bunch of animals, that's awesome. You can make some money on the gain. But if you have, you could easily not make much money if you have a bunch of animals that are poor doers. So I try to take the high road and just charge per day. And over probably now going on 25 years of this, we've pretty much settled in between 1.8 and like 2.2 pounds of gain, depending on the grass, the year, the dryness, the wetness. So I, you know, and that's over a 240, 230 day graze. Huh. So that apparently works for my customers because they keep coming back.
So really that's not bill. That much different than here. I mean, we're pretty excited if we get a set of heifers to break the 2 pound.
Oh, mark. Really?
Are the drier years better or are wetter years better for gain per day?
I would say drier years, but I don't want any of those. the problem is now it's, you don't know what you're going to get. You know, it's the spottiness. You know, in my 40 years, I've certainly had a good time learning. You know, if you think way back 40, well, yeah, if you think way back to 1980, what was going on with the Stockman grass farmer and, you know, how it's morphed in over the years. I mean, at one point we were intensive management grazers, intensive grazing, not intensive managing.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, we didn't want any waste. And then, I've been through almost every genre. Some I adopted and then I learned it took like 5 years to get off that grazing club. I was in a grazing club. We all wanted to, and then I learned about this and this, and now we're talking about taking the top third and trampling and mobbing and resting and, we're managing and we're intensive. And now adaptive
multi-paddock.
And my term, cause I'm lazy, I just linger graze. I just kind of sit here and go, I want my own moniker. I'm very selfish. I want my own that feels better. It feels right. When you linger, it feels more like God's work. Yeah. You know, that, AMP, I don't know. Doesn't feel as, or whatever. At any point in my daily life here on the farm, managing pastures and cows, I could be doing all of them on one day. So I don't know. We're just grazing. We're lingering. We're learning. I don't know what label that is.
Sure.
But I've certainly learned a lot of techniques and things to overcome some of those challenges of too wet, too dry, too this, too that. So,
very good.
Yeah.
Okay. So every one of your riffs produces another question or three, which is great. No, you're doing great. I have had this question written down since like the first one. So I want to back up. What does the NRCS say carrying capacity is for your county, your area?
What does NRCS say? So
stocking rate, carrying capacity.
3% of their body weight.
Well, no, like how many animals per, or how many acres per cow calf pair for a year? Do you know?
I'm gonna call it depends. So what that their standard. I plan so many farms. I work with so many farms. That's almost caught me off guard. You know, generally they talk over here about 1.5 to 2 acres per cow.
Okay.
And so in organic, which I, for the last 9 years or 8 years, I was certified organic, but they talk about 2 to 3 or 4 per acres per animal as a carrying capacity, because they got hay, they want to rest more,
sure,
those types of things. But I'm using the depends because it totally depends on goals, soil types, and all those types of things you already know about.
Sure.
But yeah, when you guys talk in the West, I mean, I hear like crazy numbers, like 40 acres
yeah.
per yeah. cow. That's
the county, like, I grew up in was 40 acres.
I don't even have, I have no context.
The county I'm in now is closer to 35, some guys 30. But that's where I'm going with that question, is that guys who are moving every 3 to 4 days in this part of the world, or even, and more, you know, some guys, your results may vary. It depends, whatever, you know, but those guys are seeing a doubling of that. So they can get it down to, like, I know a guy who's raising, registered selling bulls, and he's got it down to 17 acres per cow calf pair, you know, wow. So he's more than doubled the
neighborhood. And I don't even know what that means. Like I'm literally parked my pickup here in a 5 acre field, and that's good for 5 days for 50 head.
Right. And then it is here too, if you never come back until next year.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Like that. I don't. Okay. So I guess we're pretty lucky.
So that's what I'm trying to say. Like, does your management add anything to that? You know, are you experiencing those same, you know, again, disclaimer, your results may vary. Are you experiencing the same doubling of the carrying capacity, that you're, you know, that we are out here with daily moves?
No.
What's the advantage?
Of what?
Of daily moves.
Animal performance.
Okay.
The advantage of daily moves, you can affect the trample factor or whatever grazing pattern. You know, we're a dairy state, so animal performance, milk production, beef production, you know, lamb production, whatever, you know, that's where it's at. So that movement to fresh feed is, you know, super important. And building, you know, recovery times in that. So, you know, over here, we don't have 1,000 acres. I sit on a 100-acre farm, and, you know, my neighbors have a couple hundred acres and a 50-acre farm, and, you know, we just don't have the big scales, so we work in those smaller. But, you know, we can get away with it because we have more water. I don't know. A lot of our soils here in Central New York are pretty darn good. Where I work in Madison County, the soils are really good north and not so good in the hills of shale country. And so, you know, it all depends, but you can do better with managing. It's part of that balance of recovery times, animals, stocking rate. Right. Intensity and this and that. And, you know, because we live in a humid, wetter environment, it certainly does come with challenges. And some of the stuff that I have adopted at times, too much rest makes weed pressure, you know. And
is that more woody species then coming in? Is that what it is?
Yeah. Or, or like I'm a farm that has spotted, well, I don't know what it's called. I guess purple knapweed, whatever kind of knapweed it is, purple flower. You know, these species, they just love rest. So over-resting is actually one, over-resting is one of the problems. Like trying to make hay and getting feed off. Bed straw is another one that like flowers it underneath the cutter bar, you know, and it just loves rest. So if you want to, you know, you want to do some of these techniques, you know, you have to be quite spirited in getting them done, because I've experienced too much rest where next year your weed pressure is like twice. So, you know, it ebbs and flows.
Sure.
So we all have advantages and disadvantages, but, I mean, so then you could say, well, Whippy, for you, we could talk about taxes, you know, property taxes and things. I mean, I don't really want to talk about it because you don't want our taxes here.
Nope.
So, we have to perform some agricultural scale or management, because it costs a lot of money to have land over here,
right?
Or not to maintain the land. Everything costs more in New York, I guess. That's probably a saying somewhere.
So earlier you mentioned that you were a dairy. Was it a grass-based dairy or what kind of dairy was it?
It was a dairy, that had grass. My grandfather and my dad, you know, we had day and night pastures, and almost the whole farm was in forage. So that was good, because we got hills and we're in the snow belt. And so, you know, that was good. The plateaus, my grandfather was never a cropper. My dad was never a cropper. You know, we grazed, we made hay. We might've had a little corn or sorghum, but that was about it. So, and frankly, back in those 80s when I was milking cows, I came out of college, I figured I'd be a dairy farmer the rest of my life. I made tremendous amounts of milk. I was anointed the young farmer of Oneida County at one point or something. I don't know. I can't even remember, you know, I was on the rise. You know, it was all well and good. I was just starting to, my college career said, make a lot of milk and you'll be successful. They forgot to say, make a lot of milk, but don't use a lot of inputs. Oh, I forgot. I learned nothing in college about grazing. I learned grazing from Daryl Emick and a lot of my mentors that are still going today, because I had to. That's actually where I made the money. But long story short, when you get $10 a hundred for milk, and it doesn't matter what you graze or what you're doing, there's no money in it. And so we had a debt threshold and we quit. And it was one of those, I mean, I don't know how many farmers have to go through this in their lifetime, but that was a pivotal moment for me in agriculture. You know, that really hurt. It really hurts now, you know, because some of the best cows I've ever owned, I had to sell.
Yeah.
But it was the most sound decision, you know, based on our goals, and my dad's an accountant. So, I mean, he knows. We have not taken on any debt. And so when people talk about the business of grazing, or, you know, hey, you graze, you do this or this, one of our main components for a living here for 140 years and six generations is we manage debt, or we manage to have very little debt. And so we can operate on lower prices, maybe for custom grazing, than others can, or we can operate differently. We can experiment with our farm. We can do different things because we don't have to worry about a big fat mortgage or something that impedes us from researching, learning, and celebrating what God gave us. It happened actually, you know, that little snippet basically set us on a better path to all the way till today. Because sure. If we had not done that and taken on more debt and tried to say, oh, it'll be better tomorrow, I'd be scared to find what would have happened.
Yeah. So that's good. And I've got more notes here that we'll come back to that. But from that transition to dairy with forage, I think is how you described it, to custom grazing, have you seen changes in the land since that transition happened?
That you 100%. I'm really sad. My grandfathers didn't live long enough to see what this place has become. It's truly breathtaking almost. Huh. You know, at one point in our journey, we had 100 cows here grazing, and you know, we were feeding them. And when my grandfather was farming, he had 14. So, you know, when, it's funny because, you know, I work very little with FSA, generally, they say that we only farm 65 acres because that's what's suggested is cropland. And I said, well, what about the rest of it? Well, we don't even count that. Huh. I'm like, yeah, that other 40 is pasture, and so is the 60.
Right.
It's all a pasture crop. And, you know, the more you feed it, the more you manage it, the more it gives you. And so we've come to the conclusion now after 40 years. And again, a lot of learning and a lot of mentors and a lot of podcasts and a lot of stuff, all good, great information, great talking, great listening, is we make more money at a lesser stocking rate, grazing more days and stockpiling and doing the things that the land will give us than feeding hay and wintering. We make more animal. We make more money with less animals for more grazing days. More grazing days equals more money.
Right.
Period. So the more grazing days, finding that right size to have that sweet spot where you can do, where you can you know, graze just fine and then stockpile and do those types of things is basically what continues to be unattainable on a 365 day basis, but it's something I want to attain at some point. Keeps me hungry. And having a variable stocking rate, right now we're a little, you know, we're stocked up, but on July 4th, the heifers are going back to get bred back at the my customer's farm, and so we're going to drop some, but that allows us to stockpile and do stuff because we really do, even in central New York with, you know, I don't know, 120 inches of snow. We still want to graze through February or March even, you know. I still think with how the climate is still weird, what's happened here is we have our months are 1 month off. So December feels like January. So the growing season's 2 weeks longer, and gotcha. I keep track of this stuff. So it's gospel. I keep track of it. It's 2 weeks longer. And so what happens is because it's a little bit warmer, we get an early snow and then it melts generally and it goes away. And if you had forage, you could graze, which in my entire life here was not possible. It's becoming possible.
So 2 weeks longer compared to what?
2 weeks longer. Growing season in the fall.
Compared to what?
Compared to not? Compared to what?
Like the neighbor's place? Compared to
just in our region right here.
Gotcha.
Or I could say, yes, I could say on our farm. We're actually, because of stockpiling and recovery periods and all the learning, we start earlier and we end later. So typically we would be grazing, let's say, back in the day, I keep going back, you know, 180 day, 100, 200 days. That isn't even in the radar anymore. If we're not doing 240, 230, 220, I mean, we're slackers. it's habit now.
Right.
The forage base, the management, the learning, and all these things, the soil health and everything has afforded us to start earlier and go later with no detriment to the environment.
Sure.
Which is really awesome for everybody.
And so the 120 days that you're not grazing, is that when you're under the 120 inches of snow?
Typically, yeah. We used to winter cows for the last 8 years. We had organic dairy heifers on the farm, and we were not profitable doing that. It was great to get the fertility and so forth and so on, but my dad's an accountant. He crunched the numbers and said, "You're not making any money. Stop doing it." Okay. So, then our business kind of changed, and, now we have winters off, and, John Marble, my friend, and others have said, "Boy, you're really lucky. I really like that paradigm." I'm like, "Yeah, you know, I do like it. I have to admit." So, but that's a goal. That's a choice. That's a plan.
Yeah.
We have facilities, you know, we could winter some cows. We could do some stuff, and we may do it again because we have some blacktop. We have a couple barns. We have a feed rail. You know, I have a Bobcat tractor with all the attachments, you know, so we could entertain that, but it would have to be profitable. And profit means our customers have to be profitable for us to be profitable. Everyone in the chain has to be profitable. So, you know, right down to, you know, the guy that makes the feed. So if it's not profitable all the way through, it's not profitable. So,
yeah. So I want to define some terms. You talk about stockpiling. Is that just leaving it stand, or are you go out and clipping it off after the cows leave and then coming back to it while it's laying there?
Stockpiling to me is what I think is somewhat traditional. So, somewhere around August 10th, because that's 60 days back from our first frost generally, although the frost date is moving back. It's moving towards Halloween. So that's kind of a weird. Anyway, somewhere around the 10th of August, we start we definitely change our recovery times, and we can, if the rain is here, we can set aside paddocks. And I have done both and with mixed results. So I might set aside paddocks and just let them grow for 60 days and then just keep grazing the others. But on a 100-acre farm, you know, how much can you really do? It's sort of like how many cows are you carrying? We've done a couple of Greg Judy type things where we just basically throw them in to top it real quick in hopes that it will recover real fast, like it never even happened. And then when the frost hits, then we take a lot more of it. So it sort of depends, but we basically think about stockpiling in a traditional way. It's just it's more difficult here when we don't have extra acres. So that is a something that is always a learning experience. And I think I've heard Jim talk about it on your podcast and others talk about stocking for winter grazing, you know, and having the variable stocking rate so you can diminish the herd size so you can stockpile. A lot of our farms that I work with and farms in general can't do that because of financial reasons. They can't get rid of the cows. You know, you got a land base, they have to maintain X amount of cows to pay the bills. We're a little bit different. We have variable stocking, right? We can add cows, take away cows, but the goal is to make money for our customer and make money for us. And the easiest way to do that is with stockpile forage, because we have documented that a winter feed cost on a cow is between $225 and $260
per day.
Okay. And that might be low. And so we can graze cows for $1.25. So there you go. If we've got, you know, which sort of begs the question in my mind on a lot of farms now that are getting out of dairy is, when is the grass most needed? And when can you capitalize on your grass? You know what? I'm thinking it's in October. Like, we need winter grazing farms where you sell your grass and you just move cows 10 minutes a day. And that's because all of us have grass now. It's the one we need grass in October, November, January, February, March. We need a forage chain that takes care of that. And if there was such a thing, those folks could make their money with very little. I'll talk abstract, let's say less inputs and save us money. They make money and we don't have that $2.50 a cow per day. You know, I think there's room for opportunity, but, you know, nobody's really doing that. And Greg Judy has said this, I don't know, at least a couple times. I know I'm name dropping, but Greg has said some of his most profitable ventures was grazing dry beef cows in the winter, you know, fall, winter, is because nobody else had any grass. And they're so, you know, they're so easy to keep. So, and it saves the customer a ton of money. I mean, if you can graze grass, graze cover crops, graze something, you know, $2.50 really adds up.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. What are the obstacles to doing that where you're at?
Well, snow. the will and the heart and the mind of a farmer, because that's different. It's different. You know, you have to plan for it. You have to build relationships with somebody like myself. Like, I don't have any, I like relationships. Look, if I can do something for 240 days and you can do some stuff for the other time, and in the end, our customer wins, that's a win for all of us. Because it costs so much to feed cows, you know, if you have, like, I don't know, what is a winter forage? And, you know, you have to have fences, and yes, you will have snow, and you will have to buy some hay and whatever. And I'm like, I feel like there's some knowledge from folks that do it out your way very effectively. They need to come east and either take over some farms or teach us how to do it or something, because I think we're leaving a lot on the table.
I can't tell you how many times people have told me that one of the advantages of our region is the wind, because it blows the snow away. and it gives you the opportunity to graze.
Part of it is, well, from my perspective, and I really haven't been to the West, one of my perspectives is it's drier. Because right in our neck of the woods, we have perpetual Novembers. It just keeps, it's muddy. You know, that is our detriment. And so when it's raining and muddy and not quite frozen and kind of slushy and whatever, your forage base just goes to mush. And you just can't carry the cows. So, you know, we need a forage. Let's say we need a miraculous forage that does all that. And most of us in this neighborhood, dairy country, we do not want fescue. But even as I say that, I'd really like to have some. But then I don't want any. I don't want any. But I do want it. You know, I actually want somebody else to have it. So we could have a fescue farm where we could take animals and, you know, take them over, you know, 10 miles away or whatever and put them there for the winter.
Right.
So again, crazy concept. Can it happen? Absolutely. It takes some profitability from all parties and some planning and somebody to say yes.
Right.
Maybe this podcast will, initiate something.
Sure. Yeah. No, it's good to get that stuff out there. It's definitely a possibility.
You imagine, I've seen the numbers because I live and work here. There was a study done not very long ago in Vermont that said on paper, with all the costs, it cost a farmer $650 a cow minimum to keep a cow alive for a year.
Yeah.
And I don't know what it costs in the West. I've heard a lot less number.
Depends on the operation. I mean, there's people higher than that. There's people a lot lower.
Really?
Than that. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. That's crazy.
But that's just, you know, that's just growing less forage in a drier climate and then having to put up some hay or buy some hay and those things. So, just depends on how you're doing the numbers. Is depreciation included in there? Is it not? You know, I mean, there's a lot. It just depends on who's doing the math, I guess. But
yep.
Anyways, yeah, very, very good stuff. Really appreciate your time today. We could go a lot of directions. A couple of things I'd like to do as we point towards wrapping up here. If you could share a few of the lessons learned in the, you know, 40 some odd years, you said you've been doing the custom grazing thing. If you could share a few of the lessons you've learned in that time, I think that would be valuable.
Well, I guess because I have it right in my pickup here, my grazing plan, my grazing chart, my tool that I advocated for is probably the number one thing that I, back in the day, I kept it in my head. Like, that's stupid. You can't do that.
Yep.
And so plotting moves, monitoring moves, writing stuff down, keeping a diary. And I was talking today about when you plan something, you have to get success at some point or you're going to quit planning. So when you plan and things work, that's awesome. So you want to keep planning, you want to keep building inventory. And that is one of the most resilient things that I can say is that management piece, the keeping your head straight about you and keeping your forage inventory plotted, measured, walked, observed, whatever you do, relieves stress and it makes for a more successful, profitable business. So, you know, whatever tool you end up using, you know, part of the custom grazing thing is I'm not owning stuff. And so we're fortunate to have a few tractor places one in particular, Clinton Tractor. If I need something, I rent it, and I don't own it. I don't want to own nothing. I can go and get a brand new piece of equipment, run it for a few days. And so you plan your business around that. Huh. If I had another tidbit, it would be to, we finally, after, you know, many broken gates and stupid things happening and almost getting killed, some kind of a corral system that's portable. So like, if you're going to go into this business, you know, there's certain things you should have, that would be something to plan for, because you never know what's going to happen. And, I am never unhappy if I have more power on the fence than I can never have enough power. I will never scrimp like I did in the early days on power. So I think I started with a 5-joule unit, a Gallagher, and I had sticker shock at $300. And now, the way things have worked out, right now we have a 24-joule unit. I'm pumping out $7,000. You know, life is better. you know, you have control, you have better night's sleep. You know, those types of things. But, and again, you have to cultivate relationships, with whatever, with your customers, with other people, because having a really fine, awesome network of people, including your family and your wife and your grandkids, it's awesome. So that relationship piece cannot be understated. I mean, you have to build them early. And so I'm lucky to have friends from all over the country, you know, that I can talk to if I have a problem. I can be mentored, you know, be a lifelong learner. And one of the things that's got, because I've worked at the conservation district, I've worked in agency life, I'm going to give some street cred out to those folks, because, you know, I was just kind of a farmer, you know, doing stuff. I have learned a tremendous amount from those land professionals, you know, stuff that I would not have learned, like the importance of shelter belts, riparian areas, you know, the quality of the trees, you know, water quality features. You know, you get different perspectives, and you can totally incorporate them on your farm. So, you know, you got to find the right ones. Some are a little more bureaucratic than others, but man, there's a lot of good people out there. You just have to find them, and you have to cultivate those relationships, because right now we have a really, really pretty farm. And a pretty farm can also make money from photography, wedding venues, just fun kids camping, cows grazing, fishing. And we have a hunting lease. And, you know, all those things. Your farm is your nucleus that has so many benefits that we're not even scratching the surface, because we're always talking about production. Yeah. So there's a lot of ways to a lot of ways to make money, but there's also a lot of ways to be happy. Huh. I have to my holistic management practitioners that have helped me learn about soil health and looking at holistic contexts, is, you know, making quality decisions and setting goals and stuff. And man, you know, I hate that. we're hugging, or, you know, there was a talking stick, and a circle. There's always a circle, like, well, you can't talk and you have to listen. And, you know, I kind of laughed at it at first, but I'm telling you, the Don Campbells of the world, they're pretty awesome. Huh. So the more you think about the little things, it makes the bigger things a lot.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah.
Very good. Yeah. Troy, I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Where could I send people to get in touch with you to see what you write, see the pictures you take, some of those things?
Well, you can go over to the grasswhisper.com. My friends over at Alder Spring Farm out there in
Idaho.
Yes, the ladies helped me rebuild my website, so I have a little more. I'm frankly a little embarrassed that it's. I had this goal that I was going to be blogging more and doing more. Well, work came along and I haven't had a chance, but that's a good place to start. And if you're interested in what we do here, conservation wise, or our grassland programs and things, you can go to the Upper Susquehanna Coalition, and that's at the usc.org.
You're not going to ask me to spell Susquehanna? Thank you.
I'm not even sure I can, right off the cuff. Yeah.
All right. Well, the show notes page for today is workingcows.net/195. We'll have links to all of that there. You can go check out workingcows.net/195 to catch up with Troy and see what he's up to and get in touch with him. So, Troy, thanks for your time today.
I really appreciate what you folks do, and I thank you very much for having me. Yeah, have a great day.
And this is releasing on Troy's birthday. So happy birthday to Troy, and shout out to him, and check out the show notes page for today for links to his blog, and maybe go over and drop him a line and wish him a happy birthday. And very, very good stuff there with Troy. Really appreciate his time. So coming up next week on the Working Cows podcast, really looking forward to being joined again by Steve Campbell. Steve's previous episode was one of the more highly responded to episodes, and I really enjoyed it as well. Really, really helpful for me. So really looking forward to talking to Steve. We're going to take a little bit of different approach this time, and we're going to talk to Steve about what we can do to get more out of lignified forage using sea salt. So pretty interesting conversation coming up next week with Steve Campbell on the Working Cows podcast. We'll see you then.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.